see that he's cautious.
I think it's time you push off.
As if Thomas Grattan hasn't spoken, Sean leans into Mutt, and he says, 5 years I've kept you alive on that beach. That's what your father asks of me, and that's what I'll keep doing. You'll ride. What I tell him, you'll ride.
He turns to Grattan and nods sharply, suddenly old before striding inland.
Mutt makes an obscene gesture to his back. When Mutt sees Grattan looking at him, he takes his time, lowering his hand and putting it in his pocket.
Matthew,
Grattan says.
It's late.
Dr. Horsall glances in my direction, his eyes narrow as if he's convincing himself of what he sees, and I hurry to retrieve Finn's bike before he can say anything. I should be off anyway. Like Thomas Grattan said, it's late, and I have to be up early tomorrow. Sean Kendrick is no one to me that his worry should be mine. He's just another rider on the beach. Chapter 11. Puck. That night, I dream about Mum teaching me to ride. I'm nestled in front of her, like we are one creature, her arms around me. Her fingers are stubby like mine, and it's easy to compare them. My hands are fisted on the pony's mane, and hers are light on the reins. It is neither raining nor sunny, but somewhere in between, as it often is on Thisbe. My hands are wet with the sky's sweat. Don't be nervous, she tells me. The wind beats her hair against my face, and my hair against hers. It's the same color as the ruddy fall cliff grass that bows down to the ground and back up again. The Thisbe ponies love to run, but it's easier to get a barnacle off a rock than a cow and woman off a horse. I believe her, because she feels like a centaur, like she's part of the pony. It's impossible for either of us to fall. I wake from my dream. I have a memory of the door to the house closing, and I think this is what woke me. I lie there, looking at nothing because the room is too dark to see, waiting for my eyes to adjust or waiting for sleep to return. I wipe some of the tears off my cheeks. After a few minutes, I start to doubt that I actually heard the door close. But then there's a smell of salt water, momentarily terrifying, and Gabe, standing at the door to my bedroom, peering in. I can see the line of his neck as he looks. Inside my head, I say, please come in, over and over again. I want so much for him to sit on the end of my bed, like he used to, before our parents died, and ask me what my day was like. I want him to tell me he's changed his mind, and I don't have to ride after all. I want him to say where he's been out so late. But most of all, I just want him to come in and sit. He doesn't. He silently knocks his fist against the door jamb, as if I've said something to disappoint him. Then he turns away, and eventually I fall back asleep. But I don't dream of our mother again.
Sean. The Malvern stables are a haunted place at night. Though I have already been awake for 17 hours, and need to be up in another 5 if I'm to have the beach to myself in the morning, I don't go straight up to my flat. Instead, I take my time in the chilly stable, walking up and down the dimly lit aisles, making sure that the grooms have fed and watered the thoroughbreds and drafts as they were supposed to. They've mucked out most of the stalls, but now that it's nearly November, they're too cowardly to enter the few stalls occupied by the Capel Ishka, even when I had the water horses down at the beach. Part of that is the water horses' reputation, I think, and part of it is the stables. Regardless, it leaves me with 3 stalls I don't want the Capel Ishka to stand in all night. As head trainer, my time's supposed to be too valuable to be bothering with mucking, but I'd rather do it myself than have Malvern's 2 new frightened mice do it badly. So while the horses make their soft, slow night noises, and the dark, knowing walls of this place hold me close, I clean out the 3 stalls. I wipe down the surfaces in the feed room. I give the water horses their meat, though I think they're too wound up to eat it. And all the while, I imagine that this massive stable is mine, that these horses I care for are in my name, that the buyers who try them will nod approvingly at me instead of at Benjamin Malvern. The Malvern stables are not truly the Malvern stables, after all, but a complex of stone barns that housed horses on Thisbe long before the Malvern name existed on the island. The only thing that can match these buildings in stature, especially the main stable, is St. Columba's in Skarmouth. The barns were constructed with the same spiritual fervor. The ceiling is held up with carved columns that depict wide-eyed men whose hands support the feet of men whose hands support the feet of other men in turn, and again in turn, and at the top of all of them are men with the heads of horses. Like the church in Skarmouth, the sloped ceiling of the main barn is supported with ribs of stone, and in between, the surfaces are painted with complicated animals whose limbs knot around each other. The walls, too, are painted, with small twisted figures jotted into the oddest places. A corner of a stall in the center of the floor, along the left side of windows. Men with hooves for hands, and women coughing up horses, and stallions with tentacles for manes and tails. And the most impressive painting of all covers the wall at the end of the main stable. In it, there is the sea and a man, a forgotten ocean god, perhaps, dragging a horse down into it. The water is the color of blood, and the horse is red as the sea. It's an old animal, this stable, the oldest on the island. Everywhere in it are clues to the stable's previous life. The stalls are so large that in all but three, Malvern has put up dividers so that he can accommodate more of the sport horses that he sells on the mainland. The door frames are iron. The door handles will turn only counterclockwise, and there is something written in red runes above one of the thresholds. The floor of the tamed stall, the stall closest to the cliffs, is stained with blood. The walls arched with a spattered spray like sea foam. Malvern has repainted it many times, but when the morning light comes in full and strong, the stains are still visible. One of them is the print of a human hand, fingers splayed near the door handle. It was not always stylish sport horses that were housed in this barn. I finish with the stalls and the feed room, and every other chore that I can think of performing, and then I shut down the lights so it's just me in the dark, ancient stomach of the stables. One of the Kapil Ishka makes a clucking sound and another one replies. Even though I know the horses, the sound instinctively makes the hairs on my arms rise. Every other horse in the stable has gone silent and watchful at the noise. The thing is, I don't actually want the Malvern stables, not in either of its forms. I don't want Malvern's rich buyers coming each October to watch the races and buy his thoroughbreds. I don't want his money and his reputation and his ability to come and go as he pleases from Thisbe. I don't need 40 head of horses to feel complete. What I want is this. A roof over my head that is my own. Accounts at Grattan's and Hammond's in my name. And, most of all, I want Cor. For the first time in 9 years, I lock the door to my flat, thinking of Mutt Malvern's purple face and fisted hands. I lie awake for a long time, listening to the ocean violent against the rocks of the northwestern shore of the island, and thinking about the piebald mare. Finally, I sleep, and when I do, I dream of a day when I can turn my back on Mutt Malvern and keep walking.
Chapter 12. Puck. The morning is raw and pink as I make my way out to Dove's pasture. Cold as a witch's tit, my father used to say, and my mother would say, "Is that the sort of language you're teaching your boys?" And apparently it was, because Gabe said it just the other day. It's not cold enough to freeze the mud, however. Only every few years does it ever get cold enough for that. So I slide and stomp and shiver my way across the muddy yard. I'm trying not to notice that I'm nervous. It's nearly working.
I call Dove's name and bash the coffee can of feed against the fence post. It's not a lot. I'll feed her more after we've worked. But it's enough to tantalize her. I can see her muddy rump poking out from the lean-to. Her tail doesn't even move as I jostle the can again. I jump, as Finn says, right at my elbow.
She knows you're cranky. That's why she won't come over.
I glower at him. Somewhere, someone in Skarmouth is making meat pies because I can smell them on the wind and my stomach grumbles as it rolls to point in the direction of the scent. I am not cranky. Aren't you supposed to be cleaning the kitchen or something? Finn shrugs and stands on the lowest rung of the fence. He seems unperturbed by the cold.
Dove!
He calls gaily. I am gratified to see that Dove doesn't move an inch for him either.
Well, he says, she's a useless mule. What are you doing today?
Taking her down to the beach, I say. I touch my nose with the back of my hand. It's that sort of cold that makes me feel like it's going to run, even though it's not.
The beach? Finn echoes. Why?
The idea of answering him irritates me as much as the answer does, so I pull the rule sheet out of my woolly jacket pocket and hand it to him. I rattle the can while he unfolds the sheet, and try not to feel sorry for myself as he reads. It takes him a while to get to the rule that answers his question. I can tell exactly when he gets to it, because his mouth gets thin. I had thought, when I first decided to ride Dove in the races, that I would be able to exercise her far away from the beach and go down there only for the race. But the rule sheet that Peg Grattan gave me tells me I can't. All entries must train within 150 yards of the shoreline. Penalty, disqualification with no refund of the entry fee. It feels specifically designed to thwart me. Even though I know there's a good reason for it, no one wants water horses running amok over the island as it gets close to November.
Maybe you can ask them to make an exception, Finn says.
I don't want them to notice me at all, I say. If I went to the officials and made a kerfuffle over Dove, they might disqualify me anyway. My plan seems frightfully thin at the moment, all for a brother who left before either of us got up. Finn and I both start at the sound of a car coming up the road to the house. Cars are never a good sign. Not many people on the island have them, and fewer still have a reason to come out here. Usually, the only people who come this way are men who don't take off their hats as they hand over unpaid invoices. Finn, valiant soul that he is, vanishes, leaving me to it. The same amount of money has to be handed over regardless. But it stings less if you aren't the one who has to count it out for them. But it's not a bill collector. It's a long, elegant car the size of our kitchen, with a tall, elegant grill the size of a dustbin. It has round, friendly-looking eyeballs with chrome eyebrows. Its tailpipe breathes white puffs that creep around the tires. And it is red. Not the red of the horse I saw on the beach yesterday, but red, like only humans can imagine. Red like candy. Red, like you'd like to taste or possibly paint your lips with. Red, Father Mooneyham often remarks sadly like sin. I know the car. It belongs to St. Columbus, officially, donated to Father Mooneyham for his home visits by a well-meaning parishioner who'd come from the mainland and had some sort of spiritual conversion in the waters near Skarmouth. And it is true that Father Mooneyham travels all over the island in the car, visiting the islanders and giving last rites and first rites and in-between rites. But he never budges from the passenger seat. If he can't find anyone willing to drive, he uses his bicycle as he did before, never mind that he's old as sod. I feel a little bad that Finn has hidden himself in the house, because he would have appreciated the grand red car of the priest. I tell myself it serves him right for being a coward. Before I can properly wonder why Father Mooneyham has come out here, the driver's side door opens and out steps Peg Grattan. Her feet are armoured in dark green rubber boots that are unimpressed by our mud. I see Father Mooneyham fretting over something in the passenger seat, but he remains in the car. It's Peg who has business with me, and that is a worrying thought. Puck, she says. Her short hair is curled and red, not the same colour red as either the car or the horse from the beach, and frazzled appealingly in a way that gives me hope for mine. Good morning, You have a moment? It's clever the way she says it, not as a question. I would have to contradict her in order to have my moment back. I make a note to use the method in the future. Yes, I say, and then, though it pains me to add it, because the kitchen looks like fairies have been using it for black magic all night, would you like some tea? I can't keep the father, Beck says briskly. He was kind enough to bring me out here. This, of course, is not true, as it was the other way around. I narrow my eyes at her. Seeing the red car reminds me both that I haven't been to confession in a very long time, and that I've done a great many things that I ought to confess. It's not a comfortable feeling. Now Peg hesitates. She looks around the yard. It is a bit pathetic looking. Every so often I pull the biggest of the weeds out from the edges of the fence and the house, but there are still dark, leafy intruders every place things join up. There is not much in the way of proper grass in the stretches in between, just mud. I should tell Finn to fix the wheelbarrow that is passed out in the corner of the yard. But it's not the mess that Peg's eyes rest on. It's a saddle I have set over the fence, next to my brushes, and the coffee can of grain in my hand. My husband and I were talking about you last night, right before we went to sleep, she says, and for some reason this makes me feel odd, to think of her and Ruddy Thomas Grattan in bed together, and to think of them talking about me, of all things. I wonder what they talk about when they aren't talking about me. The weather, perhaps, or the price of marrow, or the way that tourists always seem to wear white shoes in the rain. I think if I had a butcher husband, that's what I would talk to him about, Peg continues. And he seemed to think that you weren't riding one of the Kapil Ishka. I said, no, that's not possible. It's a bad enough decision to ride in the races without making it complicated. And what did he say? He said he seemed to remember, Peg says, looking at Dove's muddy tail, that the Connollys had a little dun mare by the name of Dove, which I said I thought was what you had me write down on the board last night. I hold the coffee can of grain very still. That's true, I say. Both of those things are true. That's what I thought. So I told him I was coming down here to talk you out of it. She looks less than pleased with this idea. I thought it was probably one of those ideas that sounded better when you were lying in bed with your ruddy husband rather than standing in the misty cold morning, staring at the reality of me. I'm sorry that you came all this way, I say, although I'm not, and it's unusual for me to lie before a proper breakfast, because I can't be talked out of it. She puts one of her hands on her hip and the other on the back of her head, crushing her curly hair flat. It's such a fierce posture of frustration that I feel a little bad that I'm the one causing it. Is it the money? She asks, finally. I'm not sure if I'm insulted or not. I mean, clearly, yes, we need the money, but I would have had to be the island's best fool if I thought that I stood a chance of winning against those massive horses. A part of me prickles at that, and I realize, guiltily, that a tiny, tiny part of me, small enough to dissolve in a teacup, or work a blister in the heel of a shoe, must have been daydreaming of that possibility. Beating the horses that had killed my parents on a pony that I'd grown up on. I must be the island's best fool, after all. It's for personal reasons, I say stiffly, which is what my mother had always told me to say about things that had to do with fighting with your brothers, getting any sort of illness that had intestinal ramifications, starting your period, and money. And this decision covered two out of the four, so I thought the statement was well earned. Peg looks at me, and I can tell she's trying to read between the lines. Finally, she says, I don't think you know what you're getting into. It's a war down there. I shrug, which makes me feel like Finn, which makes me wish I hadn't done it. You could die. I can see now that she's trying to shock me. This is the least shocking thing she could say, though. I have to do it, I tell her. Dove chooses that moment to emerge, and she is mud-stained and small and faintly damning. She comes over to the fence and tries to nibble the saddle. I give her a foul look. She's muscled and in good shape, but in comparison to the Kapil Ishka I saw yesterday, She's like a toy. Peg sighs and gives a nod, but it's not for me. It's a well at least I tried nod. She clumps back through the mud and knocks her boots on the edge of the car door to keep from getting so much filth inside the beautiful red car. I rub Dove's nose and feel bad about disappointing fierce Peg Grattan. After a moment, I hear my name and see that Father Mooneyham is calling me. I can't believe that Peg would have convinced Father that me on the beach is a spiritual matter, and my path to the passenger side window is a dutiful rather than happy one. Kate Connolly, Father Mooneyham says. He's a very long man, all over, with knobs for a chin bone and his cheekbones and the end of his nose. Each knob is slightly reddened. There is a knob for his Adam's apple, too, which I saw once when he had been knocked off his bicycle and his collar had gone askew. It was not reddened. Father, I say. He looks at me and puts his thumb in a little cross on my forehead, like he used to when I was small, and still spit when I was in church. Come to confession. It's been a long time. Peg and I both wait for him to say something else, but he just rolls his window back up and motions for Peg to reverse out of the yard. As they do, I see Finn's face smashed up against the bedroom window, getting a glimpse of the splendid car as it pulls away.
Chapter 13. Sean. I stand in a round pen in the Malvern yard with an American at my elbow, both of us watching Cor trot around us. It's a pale blue morning that needs time to become pleasant. I was intending to spend it on the beach before everyone else got there, but Malvern caught me and pressed the buyer onto me before I could get clear. I didn't think taking a stranger to the beach was a good idea, so I headed to the round pen to school until my visitor got bored. The rule requiring the capel to train on the shore only counts if they're under saddle, something I always take advantage of. There's not much that can be done in a round pen that will prepare you for life on the beaches. Already Cor has been going in circles at the end of the lunge line for 20 minutes. The American is enthusiastic but reverent, more awed by me, I think, than by Cor. Our accents make us cautious with each other. Quite a remarkable structure. This was built just for the Kapel Ishka? He asks. He's very careful with the last words, but his pronunciation is good. Kapel Ishka. I nod. On the other side of the stables is the round pen that I exercise the sport horses in. 16 yards across with high fence-like walls built of light metal tubing. Cor wouldn't tolerate the metal for very long, and even if he did, everyone is too afraid to put a Kapel Ishka in something that looks like it would blow away. So instead, we're in this fearfully wondrous pen that Malvern devised some time before I arrived, dug 8 feet into the side of a hill so that the earth makes a solid wall around it. The only entrance is a high dirt-walled path ending at an oak door that serves as part of the pen's wall. I like it well enough, except for when it floods. Kapel Ishka? Kapel Ishka? The American frowns now, doubting his usage. Kapel, spelt C-A-P-A-I-L-L, is plural. Kapel, spelt C-A-P-A-L-L, is singular. Roger. It's never sure if it's raining or not here, is it? Asks the American. He's very handsome, in his late 30s, wearing a navy flat cap, a white V-neck sweater, and slacks that won't stay that pressed for long in this humidity. The sky spits at us, but it's not really rain. It'll be gone before I head down to the beach with the others. How long will you trot him out? Cor is already annoyed with the gate. My father once said that no water horse was meant to trot. Any horse has 4 natural gaits: walk, trot, canter, gallop. And there's no reason for one to be preferable over another. But Cor would sooner gallop until he's lathered like the surf than trot for half the time. My mother once said that I hadn't been built to trot either, and that's true too. It's too slow to be exciting, too jolting to be comfortable. I'm perfectly content to let Cor do it on his own right now, without me on his back. At the moment, he can tell that he's being watched by a stranger, however, so he picks his feet up and tosses his mane just a little more than usual. I allow him his show. There are worse flaws than vanity in a horse. The American's still looking at me, so I reply, just taking the edge off. The beach will be crowded again today, and I don't want to bring 3 fresh horses down there. Well, he's a beauty, the American says. It's meant to flatter me, and it does. He adds, I see by your smile you already know. I didn't think I was smiling, but I did already know. I'm George Holly, by the way, the American says. I'd shake your hand if it wasn't occupied. Sean Kendrick. I know. You're why I came. They said it wasn't a race unless you were in it. My mouth quirks. Malvern said you had your eye on some yearlings. Well, I came for them, too. Holly wipes the mist from his eyebrows. But I could have sent my agent for them. How many times have you won? 4. 4? You're the man to beat. A national treasure. Regional treasure, perhaps. Does Thisbe have home rule? Why don't you race on the mainland? Or maybe you do and I've missed it. We get your news slowly, you know. George Holly didn't know it, but I had been to the mainland once with my father for one of the races there. It was vests and flat caps and bowlers and canes, horses in snaffle bits and jockeys in silks, and a track contained by a white rail and wives who looked like dolls. The benevolent hills stretched gently on either side of the stands. The sun had shone, the bets had been cast, the favorite won by 2 lengths. We came home, and I'd never gone back. I'm no jockey, I say. Cor starts to come in toward us, and I push him back out to the wall with a flick of my stick. The stick isn't long enough to touch him, but it's got a length of red leather fixed to the end, and it snaps to remind him of his place. Me neither, Holly announces broadly, putting his hands in his pockets like a boy. He rotates on his heel as I turn, watching Cor circle around us. Just a horse lover. Now that he's said his name, I know exactly who he is. I've not met him before, but I know his agent, who comes over each year to import a yearling or 3. Holly's the American equivalent of Malvern, the owner of a massive breeding farm known for show jumpers and hunters, wealthy and eccentric enough to come all the way to Thisbe for a chance to improve his stock. Horse lover is a stark understatement, albeit one that makes me like him better. And Malvern has me babysitting him. I should be flattered, but still, I'm wondering how difficult it will be to hand him off in order to get down to the beaches. Do you think Benjamin Malvern would part with this beast? Holly asks. He's watching Cor's tireless stride and imagining it, I think, on his home soil. My breath's uncertain. For the first time, I'm relieved by the answer to that question, though it's caused me sleepless nights before. Malvern won't sell his water horses to anyone. Also, it's illegal to transport the Capel Ishka from the island, but that doesn't seem like something that would stop someone like Holly. If he were a horse, I think I'd have to trot him around this round pen for a long time to take the edge off. Perhaps he hasn't been offered the right price. My fingers tighten on the lunge line enough that Cor feels the tension and flicks an ear toward me, always sensitive to my mood. He's had good offers. At least one very good offer. Everything I had saved over the years, everything from my share of the winnings. I could buy 10 of Malvern's yearlings, 10 of any of his other horses. Just not the one I want. I expect you would be the one to know, Holly says. Sometimes it's not money they're looking for. He doesn't sound upset. A man so used to both buying horses and being refused them that neither scenario surprises him. I sure do like the look of him. Malvern horses. Shit. He's so clearly delighted by it all that it's hard to fault him. I ask, how long are you here? I'm on the ferry the day after the race, with whatever Benjamin Malvern has convinced me I can't live without. Want to join me? I could use a boy like you. Not a jockey, but a whatever you call yourself. I allow him a thin smile that reveals the impossibility of this. I see how it is, Holly replies. He gestures his chin toward Cor. Can I hold him for a moment? Will he let me? He is so polite about it that I hand him the lunge line and my stick. Holly takes them delicately, his feet automatically moving apart to give him a better base of support. The stick rests lightly in his right hand, an extension of his arm. The man must have lunged hundreds of horses. Still, Cor immediately tests him. He tosses his head up and moves in, and Holly has to flick the stick at once. Cor keeps pushing inward. Snap, I say. I'm ready to take him back if I must. It has to snap. Holly flicks the stick again, this time hard enough to audibly snap the leather, and Cor twists his head, more conciliatory than ill-tempered, before trotting back out to the wall. Holly's smile is broad and pleased. How long is it taking you to get him like this?
6 years.
Could you do this with the other two mares I saw? I had tried the lunge line, in fact with the pure bay mare, and though it hadn't been a disaster, it hadn't been pretty either. Surely I wouldn't have wanted Holly or anyone else with me in the round pen that day. I'm not entirely certain that 6 years with either of the mares would end up the same way that 6 years with Cor has. I'm not sure, after all this time, if it's because he understands me better than they do, or merely because I understand him better than them. Who taught you this? Surely not Malvern. Holly glances at me. In that brief moment of distraction, the bare second it takes for Holly to look toward me, Cor surges away from the wall toward us, swift and soundless. I don't wait for Holly to react. I snatch the stick from his hand and jumped to meet Cor, pressing the tip of the stick into his shoulder. Cor rises up, away from the pressure of it, but I follow him. As he rears, I lay the red leather against his cheek, daring him to test me as he tested Holly. We've played this game before, and we both know the outcome. Cor drops to the ground. Holly lifts his eyebrows. He hands me the lunge line and wipes his palms on his slacks. First time behind the wheel. At least I didn't wrap her around a tree. He's not at all fazed. Welcome to Thisbe, I say.
Chapter 14. Puck. After Peg Grattan leaves, Finn and I pack up to go into Skarmouth. I find this pretty disagreeable, being once again denied the proud, lonely entrance on Dove. But we need to bring all of the teapots into town, and the Morris won't start. So in the most discouraging turn of events so far, I have to hitch Dove up to our little cart. My future embarrassment makes me cross, and I make a lot of noise while loading up the pottery. I have a sudden thought. How are you going to get the cart back home? I ask Finn, who is working on carefully aligning the boxes in the cart so the corners match perfectly. His side of the packing looks like he is laying bricks, but it's taking him a long time. I don't care if the largest boxes go on the bottom or the top, so long as they aren't going to crash around. I'm taking Dove down to the beach, and the cart is not going down there. I'll bring it back myself, Finn says, pleasantly. He feathers two of his fingers on the edge of a box in order to move it the distance of a butterfly's breath. Yourself? Sure, Finn says. It'll be empty then. I get a momentary image of my brother trudging out of Skarmouth with a pony cart behind him, an emaciated troll in a giant sweater, and I wish that I, too, could disappear to the mainland where no one knew my name. But it's that, or get to the beach after the tide has come up. The mist is still clinging to us, but it's starting to brighten, reminding me of time passing. Maybe Dory will let us leave it behind the shop, I say. I'll pick it back up with Dove when I'm done. Finn scratches Dove's rump with one finger, which makes her stamp her back hoof like he's a fly. He says,
Dove says she doesn't want to pull a cart after you make her run away from sea monsters. Dove says you'll look like an idiot pulling a pony cart.
He smiles vaguely at his stack of pottery boxes.
I don't mind. Obviously, I snap.
We haven't come to an agreement by the time we load up, but there's no more time. So off we go, me leading Dove and Finn trailing behind. Puffin the cat follows us for a while, with Finn shooing at her, which only makes her longing to join us more intense. Partway into town, I smell something like rotten meat on the wind, and Finn and I exchange glances. The island is no stranger to terrible smells. Storms throw up great fish onto the beaches to rot. Fishermen's spoils go bad on warm days. A cross-eyed wind brings a smell of brine and wet things in the evening. But this is not a sea smell. Something's died that shouldn't have, and has been left where it shouldn't have been left. I don't want to stop, but it could be a person. So I make Finn stand by Dove's head as I climb up over the stone wall in the direction of the scent. The wind is coming straight toward me. The wind manages to cut through the mist instead of pushing it out of the way, and I crumple over myself to stay warm as I step around sheep poo. All the while I am wishing that I could have sent Finn to investigate the smell, but he's queasy and useless with blood. So I am the lucky one to discover the source, which is a pile of parts that used to be a sheep. There's not much left but hooves, a bob of its short tail, a lump of its innards, which is what smells, and its furry skull, which is mangled and crushed around the eye socket. What's left of the wool at the back of the neck is spray-painted blue, to mark it as one of Hammond's flock. There isn't much back of the neck left to be painted, though. My skin prickles with an automatic tickle of fear, though I doubt that the Kapil Ishka responsible is anywhere near. Still, this is far inland for one of the horses to come. I return to Finn and Dove. They're playing a game that seems to involve him tapping Dove on the upper lip, and Dove looking peevish. Finn looks up and I say, "Sheep." He says,
"I knew it was a sheep."
I reply, "Next time you can cast your seeing eye into the pasture before I walk through the mud."
"You didn't ask."
And we start on again towards Skarmouth. We're headed to Dory Maud's shop, which is called Fathom and Sons, for no reason that I can imagine, as Dory has no sons and no husband for that matter. She lives with her two sisters, neither of whom are named Fathom or have sons, and she collects things year-round to sell to tourists during October and November. As a child, the chief thing I noticed about Dory was that she was always wearing a different pair of shoes, a strange and extravagant thing on the island. Now, mostly what I notice about her is that she and her sisters have no last name, a strange and extravagant thing just about anywhere. Fathom and Sons is down one of the little side streets in Skarmouth, a stone-lined track barely wide enough for Dove and her pony cart. Neither the mist nor the sun can reach inside this alley, and we shiver as Dove's hoof steps clatter and echo up the sides of the buildings. Standing in the blue morning shadows, a few doors down, is Jonathan Carroll, throwing pieces of biscuit at a collie. Both Carroll brothers have dark, curly hair, but one of them has a lump of uncooked dough for a brain, and the other has a lump of uncooked dough for his lungs. Once, when I came into town with Mum, we ran across Brian, the one with dough for lungs, crouched by the quay, shaking and starving for air. Mum had told him to breathe all of the bad air out before he tried to get more in, and then she'd left me watching him while she went to buy him a black coffee. I'd been very annoyed, because she'd promised me one of Paulson's cinnamon twists, which sold out very quickly. I'm a bit ashamed to recall that I told Brian that if he died and kept me from my cinnamon twist, I'd spit on his grave. I don't know if he remembers it at all, since he'd seemed very focused on breathing through a cup made of his hands. I hope he doesn't, because my character's improved a lot since then. Nowadays, I would have only thought the spitting part instead of saying it to his face. But regardless, it's not Brian, but Jonathan who's throwing biscuits. He looks at me and Dove and Finn and says merely, "Hi, pony," which only confirms that he's the one with dough for brains. Wait here, I tell Finn. Start unloading. I'll see about the cart. Fathom and Sons is a narrow, dark corridor of a shop, stuffed like a Cornish hen, with odds and ends labelled with little price tags that glow like white teeth in the dim light. It always smells a little like butter browning in a pan. So, like heaven. I'm not sure how many customers actually come into the shop itself to buy things. I think most of the business is done under a tent on weekends and during the rush for the races. So both the price tags and the delicious butter smell are probably unnecessary for most of the year. Today is no exception. I take a deep, slightly hungry breath as I open the door. Inside the shop, the sisters are fighting as usual. I have no sooner gotten inside the doorway and into the dim clutter than Dory Maud thrusts a catalogue into my hands. There, she says. That. You'd buy from that, wouldn't you, Puck? The sisters call me Puck instead of Kate, because all three of the sisters agree that you should be called what you want to be called, instead of simply falling into what you were given at birth. I don't remember ever telling them I wanted to be called Puck instead of Kate. Both of them are my names, but still, I don't mind it. She's got no money at all, Elizabeth says, dismissively from the stairs at the back of the shop. The stairs lead up to the second story, which the sisters share. I've never been up there, and I harbour a secret wish to. I think it must be all shoes and beds and butter. Elizabeth continues. Of course it's going to look good to her. I glance at what Dory Maud has thrust into my hand. To my surprise, it's a neatly printed catalogue for Fathom and Sons. When I tip my hands, it falls open to a random page with stylish black and white illustrations of a woman in a knitted sweater and a pair of hands, wearing crocheted gloves and a disembodied neck, bearing one of the rock cross necklaces that tourists love. The tidy letters describe each in uncompromising detail, while a banner declares, "Seize your heritage! Stretch your penny with fashion that lasts!" It looks like a real catalogue that the postboat brings, only it has all the things from the store in it. My bad mood melts away. "This is amazing!" I say. I move slightly so the dusty antique fertility statue by the door will stop poking my shoulder with her stone fingers. She's been for sale for a long time. "How did you do it? Look at the letters. They're so perfect." "Mr. Davidge, the printer, did that," Dory Maud replies, pleased, looking over my other shoulder. "Because Dory Maud did Mr. Davidge," Elizabeth says from the stairs. She's still wearing her nightgown, and her invented curls are 2 days old.
"Oh, go on back to bed," Dory replies without heat.
I don't want to think much on this. Dory is what Mum used to call a strong-looking woman, which meant that from the back, she looked like a man, and from the front, you preferred the back. Elizabeth is the pretty sister, with long straw-coloured hair and a nose turned up by lineage and habit. No one notices what the third sister, Annie, looks like, because she's blind. I page through the catalogue. I know that I'm being stalled, but I discover that I'm rather happy to be stalled. "Are our teapots in here? Who will see this?" "Oh, the three people who read the adverts at the very end of the post," Elizabeth says. She's gone up two more stairs, but is far from back in bed. "And who are willing to wait a few years for shipping?" "The post? On the mainland?" I exclaim. "I've found our teapots. There is a very precise line drawing of one of the stout pots, with my utilitarian thistles on the side of it. And now I can see that the illustrations are in the same hand that draws the adverts in the back of our own little Skarmouth newspaper that comes out each Wednesday. The printing says that the teapot pictured is a representative design and that supplies are limited. It also says that they are signed and numbered, which my teapots are not. It is strange to think of something of mine heading over the ocean without me." I point to the signed bit and ask, "What's this?" Dory Maud reads the description. "That makes them more valuable. It won't take you but a moment to sign and number them. Come in and have tea. Elizabeth will stop grousing. Where is your brother?"
I can't stay, I say regretfully. I need to take Dove to the beach.
Do you think Finn can leave the cart behind the shop when he's done unloading? I run all the words together to avoid being asked about it, but the sisters aren't paying any attention, so I needn't have bothered.
Dory Maud has opened the door and found Finn standing there, holding Puffin, who has followed us all the way to Skarmouth after all.
I hope you enjoy the taste of poverty in your bowl, Elizabeth is saying. The price of that advert was dear enough, but have you thought of what it will cost to ship those catalogues out to mainland wives?
Dory Maud says.
They pay for the catalogue. It says that right in the advertisement that I showed to you not an hour ago. If you didn't have shingles for eyes, you might have seen it. Finn Connolly, come in here. Why do you have that cat? Is she for sale as well? Has it come to that?
Finn says,
No, ma'am,
as he enters the shop, where he gets poked directly in the chest by the fertility goddess. I move a step backward so he can get away because the last thing I need is for Finn to suddenly decide to become fertile.
I really have to go, I say. I don't want to seem rude.
Where are you going again? Dory Maud asks me. Perhaps I should ring Mr. Davidge too, Elizabeth says from the stairs. Then I might not mind the bills either. How is it done, sister? Mr. Davidge, will you set my type?
Dory Maud turns to her and thunders pleasantly.
Shut up, you cow!
Finn wears his wide-eyed expression. So does Puffin.
Dory Maud seizes his arm with great enthusiasm and begins to propel him toward the back of the shop, where the teapot waits.
Bye, I whisper to him. I feel a little bad about abandoning him to their clutches, but at least he'll get tea out of it. I let the door close behind me. Dove, patiently waiting by the door, looks up as I step out. Finn has unfastened the cart, but she still wears her harness. She doesn't look much like a racehorse. I pull my hair back into a new ponytail. 2 or 3 dozen strands had already begun to escape. I probably don't look much like a jockey either.
Chapter 15. Sean. There's a girl on the beach. The wind's torn the mist to shreds here by the ocean, so unlike on the rest of the island, the horses and their riders appear in sharp relief down on the sand. I can see the buckle on every bridle, the tassel on every rein, the tremor in every hand. It is the second day of training, and it's the first day that it isn't a game. This first week of training is an elaborate, bloody dance where the dance partners determine how strong the other ones are. It's when riders learn if charms will work on their mounts, how close to the sea is too close, how they can begin to convince their water horses to gallop in a straight line, how long they have between falling from their horses and being attacked. This tense courtship looks nothing like racing. At first, I see nothing out of the ordinary. There is the surviving privet brother beating his grey couple with a switch, and Hale selling charms that will not save you, and there is Tommy Falk flapping at the end of the lead as his black mare strains for the salt water. And there is the girl. When I first see her and her dun mare from my vantage point on the cliff road, I am struck first not by the fact that she is a girl, but by the fact that she's in the ocean. It's the dreaded second day, the day when people start to die, and no one will get close to the surf. But there she is, trotting up to the knee in the water, fearless. I make my slow way down the cliff road to the sand. Any wicked thoughts Cor might have had this morning have been jolted out by his trot earlier. But the two mares are neither as tired nor as tame as Cor. Their hooves jangle every time they dance sideways. I've tied bells around their pasterns, reminding me every moment that I cannot let down my guard. The worse of the two mares wears a black netted cloth over her haunches. The cloth, passed down from my father, is made of thread and hundreds of narrow iron eyelets, part mourning cloth, part chainmail. I hope it weighs her to the ground. It's the sort of thing I'd never use on Cor, It would only make him irritable and uncertain, and in any case, we know each other better than that. Now, closer to the surf, I see why the girl's so brave. Her horse is just an island pony, with a coat the color of the sand, legs black as soaked kelp. I see from her belly that the poor Thisby grass has stuffed her but not fed her. I want to know why she's on my beach. And I want to know why no one's confronting her. All of the horses are aware of her, though. Ears pricked, necks arched, lips curled up in her direction. And of course, there's the piebald mare among them, wailing her hunger and desire. I should have known Gory wouldn't let her go. At the sound of the piebald couple, the Dun Island mare lays her ears back to her neck with fear. She knows that she's a meal here, that the sound the piebald makes is a plea for her death. The girl leans and pats the Dun's neck, soothing her. Reluctantly, I turn to go about my business. My mouth tastes of salt, and the wind finds me wherever I lead the horses. Today's one of those days where no one will get warm. I find a crevasse in the cliffs, a giant's axe mark, and lead the mares and core into it. The wind makes a muted scream at the apex of the crevasse, like someone dying out of sight. I draw a circle in the sand and spit into it. Cor watches me. The mares watch the ocean. I watch the girl. My thoughts turn the mystery of her presence over and over as I flip open my leather bag and remove the wax paper bundle I put in there earlier. I toss the bits of meat into the circle, but the mares don't touch them. They're watching the pony and the girl in the ocean. A more interesting meal. With the bag over my shoulder, I return to the mouth of the crevasse and cross my arms, waiting for a gap in the murder of horses and men to open so I can see the mare and girl again. There's nothing special about the mare, nothing at all. A fine enough head, good enough bone. As a pony, she is a beauty. As a Kapil Ishka, she is nothing. The girl, too, is nothing special. Slight, with a ginger ponytail. She looks less afraid than her mare, but she's in more danger. I hear one of my mares scream, and I turn long enough to flip open my bag and throw a handful of salt in her direction. She jerks her head up as some of it sprinkles her face. She's offended, but not hurt. I look her in the eye long enough that she knows there's more where that came from. She's a bay, no white markings on her anywhere, which is supposed to speak to her speed, but I've yet to get her going in a straight enough line to find out. I turn back to the ocean, and the wind throws sand in my face, hard enough to offend, but not to hurt. I smile a thin smile at the irony and turn up my collar. The girl circles her pony through the water again. I have to appreciate that she's chosen the only place she can be sure that no one will approach her today. Of course, it's not just the Kapil Ishka on the beach the girl has to worry about, but I can tell that she's already considered that. She glances toward the curve of the incoming surf every so often. I can't imagine that she'd be able to see a hunting Kapil Ishka when they swim parallel to the breakers, fast and dark beneath the surface. They're almost impossible to see. But I also can't imagine not looking. Somewhere close by, a man is moaning. He's been trampled or thrown or bitten. He sounds resentful or surprised. Did no one tell him that pain lives in this sand, dug in and watered with our blood? I watch the girl's hands on the reins, the certainty of her seat. She can ride, but so can everyone on Thisby.
"I'll bet you haven't seen that before," says Gory's gritty voice. "Their clothes don't come off with your eyes, Sean Kendrick."
I glance at him just long enough to see that he still has the piebald mare, and then a second longer so that he sees that I am looking at how he still has the piebald mare. And then I look back to the ocean. There is a knot of fighting horses in front of us, growling and pawing like tomcats. Bells ring sharply. Every water horse on this beach is hungry for the sea, hungry for the chase. I glance at the piebald mare again. Gory's knotted her halter with copper wire, which does nothing but look impressive.
"She's entered in the races," Gory says.
He's smoking, and he gestures toward the girl in the surf with his cigarette.
"On that pony. That's what they're saying."
The smell of his cigarette stings worse than the wind. She means to race on that pony. She'll be dead in a week. The piebald mare paws at the sand. I see her digging out of the corner of my eye and hear her grinding her teeth. That bridles her curse. This island her prison. She still smells of rot.
"I can't sell this mare. Thanks for that," Gory says. "Your expert opinion, eh?"
I don't know what to tell him. When you traffic in monsters, that's the risk you run. That you'll find one too monstrous to stomach. Bells jangle again, and I look away from the beach, trying to find the sound with my eyes. It is not my mare's. It's not the piebald. It's just one horse in a throng of horses. But there's a sharp urgency to the sound that calls to me. Danger sings on the breeze, throws echoes off the sheer white cliffs. There are too many people on horseback today trying to prove themselves, trying to prepare, trying to get faster. They haven't discovered yet that it's not the fastest who make it to race day. You only have to be the fastest of those who are left. Suddenly, there's a shout and a terrible screaming whinny, and I turn in time to see Jimmy Blackwell throwing himself from his white-gray stallion as it leaps into the pounding waves. Blackwell rolls narrowly out of the way of another pair of spooking Ishkemers. He's older, defter. He's survived a half dozen Scorpio races.
"And you thought this mare would be trouble," Gory says.
He laughs. I'm listening, but I'm watching, too. Blackwell is still pulling himself clear of the rioting mares. It's just a petty disagreement between two savage horses, but they're all teeth and hooves. One of the men tries to tear them apart, but he's too cavalier. There's a snap of blunt teeth, and just like that, his fingers are gone. Someone shouts,
"Hey!"
But nothing else. Moved by the need to speak, but having nothing else to say. My eyes flick beyond all of them to the water, to where Blackwell's stallion half leaps, half swims, the water frothing white beneath him. His eyes are on that Dun Island pony and the girl on her back. I hear a wail, and at first I think it is a scream, but then I hear my name.
"Where's Kendrick?"
Someone is about to die. I set my bag down by the cliffs, out of the way, and I begin to run, heels digging deep into the sand. I can only be in one place at a time, and the fight on the beach is out of my control. In the surf, the Dun pony is chest deep in the water, and the white stallion rears before her, hooves slicing down toward the girl. The girl jerks the Dun mare off balance, sparing them both from the hooves, but delivering the girl into the frigid water. And that was what the Capel Ishka, a fearful, dull Pegasus with disintegrating wings of sea foam, wanted. His teeth flash, the color of dead coral, and his great head smashes against the girl as her head comes up above water. Teeth clamp onto her hooded sweater. Legs kick in preparation for his dive. I am already in the water, my fingers numb with the cold, and I swim to him through this perilous water, my progress agonizingly slow. The girl keeps going below water and clawing her way back up. I drag myself closer with the floating hairs of his tail. I straddle his back and grab a handful of mane as I make my way up his neck. There is no time to trace the outlines of his veins with iron or push him widdershins. He is beyond anything I could whisper in his ear. There is only time for me to grip a handful of death-red holly berries from my coat pocket and to press them into his flared nostrils. His massive legs slash convulsively through the water, and I see one of his knees glance off the girl's head. Can't see if she stays above water, though, because now the stallion is snorting, seaweed and jelly and bits of coral all spewing from his nostrils around the red berries, and in his drowning and his death throes, it's taking all my energy to keep from going underwater with him. The stallion's jaw swings toward me, wide open, and I see, in a suddenly frozen moment of time, the coarseness of the hairs on his jaw and the way that salt water has beaded along them. My vision explodes.